Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Does the Me Too movement have you feeling less comfortable at work? Seattle writer, New York Times columnist Lindy West says you might not think you know how to interact non-sexually with other people, but you do. She's going to be joining us in just a few minutes. I hope you can stay tuned. Now, to start the program, you know that when you fill up your car with gas, you pay a gas tax. And the money pays for transportation projects. But with more cars being hybrids and electrics, gasoline use is headed downward, and so are gas tax revenues. The state of Washington is considering replacing that revenue by charging you not by the gallon, but by the miles you drive. They're running a pilot program now, and my next guest signed up for it and found out she is apparently a bit of a problem driver. We'll talk about that. Maria Frost directs the Coal Center for Transportation at the market-oriented think tank, the Washington Policy Center. Maria, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You've been driving with a state GPS tracker for 2 weeks, and what did you find out?
Well, I found out that not only is my mileage tracked, but the DriveSync app also gives me a score on my driving based on how I accelerate, corner, brake, and speed.
Yeah, this is the most invasive of the options for tracking you, right? You went with the GPS tracker that gathers the most data about you.
Yeah, I did. I thought that would be the most informative experience. I am able to switch to a different method at least just once throughout the pilot, so I do plan to do that about halfway into the pilot to see what one of the less invasive methods is like.
There's more self-reporting involved in that?
I imagine so. I mean, for the odometer reading, I believe you'd have to take a picture of the odometer and submit it. I think some folks would have to, who don't have the capability to take a picture and send it through an app, I think they would probably have to go to the Department of Licensing. So I want to look at those options as well so I can provide a well-rounded perspective.
Okay, so speaking of well-rounded, you didn't round a couple of corners so well, according to the state. There was a little bit of harsh cornering, a little hard braking, but you drove above the speed limit 176 times?
That's what I counted over the course of 2 weeks. And what's interesting is, you know, if you are a driver who drives maybe more fast for a consistent period of time, for like 15 minutes, you know, that might be perceived as one violation by the app. But if you're a driver like me who fluctuates between 58 to 68, depending on driving conditions, depending on whether or not I'm trying to pass a vehicle or whatever judgment calls I have to make, every time I cross that 60 mile per hour threshold counts as a separate violation.
And the state is saying they're not issuing tickets at this point, if ever.
No. So what the state has said is, so you're absolutely right. The state is not collecting this additional data. They are only receiving mileage information, and it is anonymized. The private company that's collecting it, is DriveSync, is not allowed to share it during the pilot either. But what the State Transportation Commission has also said is that, quote, in official practice, lawmakers would have to decide if and how the data could be used, which really opens the door for what this might look like in actual policy. And that's where my concerns primarily lie, is what would this look like after it goes through this messy political process?
You think the state could end up collecting your data, storing it, sharing it, charging tickets as if it were like a red light camera? Is that the idea?
I think that's certainly a possibility. I mean, government in general has a propensity to keep and use the data that they have access to rather than just discard it.
Well, then ideally, if this were even to ever happen, and as you've just said, we don't know that the state would even charge you based on the data, you know, ticket you based on driving data they collect about you, but theoretically, if they did, the ticket would be more if you drove a faster speed or a sustained, drove that speed, that excess speed for a sustained amount of time compared to if you ticked above 60 for 10 seconds and then back down under, right?
I mean, they could decide to do this however they want to. I mean, if you're going a sustained speed and then you're coming down below 60 and they count that as one violation, and then they look at somebody else who's going back and forth over, you know, over and under 60 and getting multiple violations, you could look at it that way, or you could look at it based on the amount of time that you are speeding. So as you said, speeding for a shorter period of time versus a longer period of time. These are all things that are not outside the realm of possibility.
Well, it wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility to actually strictly enforce the 60 mile per hour sign, and we don't do that. We let people fudge, and that's the way it is now. And you could even you could institutionalize the fudge and say, here's how much we're going to let you fudge.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
Who knows?
Who knows? I don't know. This is all theory for now, but I do find the comments that have been made about what could happen if the mileage tax were passed into law, what this would look like in practice. What would privacy for the public look like if this were implemented? Where would the money go if this were implemented? There's a big difference between an isolated experiment like the pilot project and policy.
Yeah, where does the state say the money would go for this if they switched to the from the gas tax to the mileage tax? Would that change where the money would go?
So right now there has not been a discussion around exactly where the money would go. And that's what I find most concerning, is that's one of the questions the Washington State Transportation Commission has, is could this money be used for other transportation modes, right? And as we know, our state has a very multimodal view of transportation. They have goals to fund transit at a higher percentage than highways. The Puget Sound Regional Council also has expressed interest in having the road usage charge not be protected by the 18th Amendment, like the gas tax. The 18th Amendment, as you know, protects fuel tax dollars for highway purposes only. But there are a lot of folks who would like the road usage charge to not be restricted, so that those funds can be used to expand mass transit, making it very much not a direct user fee, but a tax.
Okay, that's the pilot program that my guest, Maria Frost, from the Cole Center for Transportation, Washington Policy Center, she's been driving for 2 weeks of this pilot program with a state GPS tracker as the state considers moving gradually or altogether from a gas tax to a mileage tax. And speaking of tracking your driving, Maria, Seattle is going to study the idea of congestion pricing, charging you money to drive your car into parts of the city at certain times. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the proposal is incredibly unfair to people who depend on vehicles to get to work, that depend on cars for their daily commute, especially to those folks who can't afford to live anywhere near Seattle. And I think it's yet another effort by Seattle to punish car owners and to push folks who cannot, who will not or cannot comply with their proposal to other cities, other places. I think it's extremely foolish for Seattle officials to think that people will simply submit and take transit.
Would there be a way to means test the congestion pricing toll, or you register as someone who uses their car for their work, things like that, using technology in that way?
I'm not sure about that. That's a great question, and something I would have to look into.
I mean, London has had congestion pricing for 15 years now, and I don't know, I understand they canceled part of it. They decided they kind of... They're still trying things, but there's not an outrage in London that I know of. Are you sure we wouldn't just get used to what seems now like an idea we wouldn't like?
I think fundamentally it raises a lot of very serious philosophical questions of fairness and equity. I don't think this is something that people should have to get used to. Seattle officials have spent years artificially reducing the supply of roads and creating the problem that we have today in downtown Seattle.
Because they won't build more highway lanes?
Well, I'm talking about road diets. I'm talking about taking bike lanes and giving them away, or taking car lanes and giving them away to bikes. Taking the viaduct and reducing capacity in the tunnel by 30%, taking I-90 and reducing its capacity by 20%. I mean, they're spending billions of dollars to make congestion worse.
Well, sometime we'll talk about other alternatives and what we're going to do about climate change and all that stuff. We'll leave it here for now, though, with Maria Frost, Kohl Center for Transportation at the Washington Policy Center. Maria, thanks for joining us on KUOW.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Maria just brought up the viaduct, talking about avoiding congested streets. The viaduct is going away this summer, but there's still a chance to enjoy its views, and not just from your car, but from your bike, because this Sunday, the Emerald City Ride is going to close some major roads to cars and open them up to bicyclists. And that will include the viaduct. It's the third year for the ride, and it's the final bike trip on the Alaskan Way Viaduct. Here is Diana Bryant with the Cascade Bicycle Club that puts on the ride.
We're talking views of the Puget Sound, the Seattle Ferry Terminal, the Great Wheel, and then looking up into the buildings of downtown. So this really is a truly historic opportunity for people to get out on their bikes and ride on the viaduct before it gets demolished.
Yeah, that's it. You get to see this remarkable view right before it gets taken away from you. We'll be back with more of The Record in just a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You walk briskly into an airport. You're running late. You need to know your departure gate. But that huge board, that big board with all the flight information that's not your flight, you've got to squint and scan. Meanwhile, the security line is getting longer. What if that board only displayed your flight information to you? And the guy standing behind you, he looks at the board and only sees his flight information. There is a new technology that can turn a screen into personalized parallel realities using multi-view pixels. Really, our friend Todd Bishop with the tech news site GeekWire tested it out. Hiya, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
Great, thank you. I'm very curious. This parallel reality display technology was developed by Five Guys in Redmond.
That's right. In a strip mall behind blacked out windows in Redmond, you would not know it was there if you walked by.
And what does it do?
So this technology uses, as you said, it's called a multi-view pixel, and they've developed it so that a standard pixel will essentially emit one color of light in all directions, and then collectively those pixels constitute a screen. Mm-hmm. With this technology, the multi-view pixel, it can emit millions of different colors of light, up to millions of different colors of light in many different directions. So effectively, if you can control that light and the colors of light emitting from the different directions as they can, you can present a different view to different people depending on where they're standing in 3D space. And on top of that, it also works with sensor technology. So those views also have the potential to follow you around based on the fact that it's sensing where you're standing.
So in the airport, for example,
yes.
I'm standing there and the screen technology knows my flight. I've got that in my pocket, right? It's on my iPhone, whatever, you know, that I get that. Knows where what flight I'm about to take, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And then it knows exactly where I'm standing, right down to the centimeter of where my cornea is?
So I actually saw this in person. And we have to be clear, some of these scenarios we're talking about are very long term.
Yeah.
But I actually saw the basics of the technology in person. They led us behind those blacked out windows. We were some of the first outsiders to see it. I took two of my colleagues. There were three of us there just to make sure that we weren't getting bamboozled. And at one point I was able to close my left eye and see one thing and close my right eye and see another. It was that precise.
Wow.
And to be clear, the scenario about the airport is one, but there are many other. Here's another good example. A theater captioning system is another thing that they're
talking about.
That
makes sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Like, it just beams my preferred language to me, the movie captions.
Right, yeah. From the same screen that the other person is seeing in Spanish.
Yes.
In the seat next to you. And this is a company that is called Misapplied Sciences. It's veterans of Microsoft and Disney Imagineering. They've come up with some pretty groundbreaking technologies in the past. So this is a legit company. They are just coming out of stealth mode, as they say. And it's really right now a technology demonstration. That is what we saw. We did not see these sort of far-flung applications that they're talking about. But certainly based on what we saw with the ability to, you and I stand right there and we're looking at the same exact screen and you would be seeing one thing and I would be seeing something completely different. Based on that, it certainly has the potential to at least have these applications long term.
Okay, so let's talk about some other potentials. I read your article in GeekWire. You mentioned the idea of why do we all have to look at the same yellow and red light? Why couldn't we get personalized information in our cars?
That's right. So it would effectively be the end of the yellow traffic light, because if it was able to sense you as a system that your car was going to make the light in time, why not just show you a green light the whole way, as opposed to the car behind you that's not going to make the light in time? It could sense that and say, okay, show that car a red light.
Except self-driving cars seem much closer to me than this technology at this point. Am I wrong about
that? Well, I would have agreed perhaps a month or so ago.
A couple weeks ago, right.
Before the tragic accident involving the Uber self-driving car.
Yeah.
Clearly, that kind of technology is something that's already on the streets and yet somewhat dangerous, as that was evidenced.
Well, let's take another example then. You mentioned in your article the idea of a stadium scoreboard,
yep,
where I could just see the players up on the scoreboard that I'm interested in seeing. So my question about that is, first of all, am I having to input data about my preferred players? That just sounds like a bunch of work. I just want to go to a baseball game.
So a lot of these applications, those kinds of details would have to be worked out. But for example, you could, through your MLB app, designate
Major League Baseball.
Right. Major League Baseball. You could designate which team you like, which players are your favorite. Your activities on the phone could indicate to the system which one you like. But even more interesting from a commercial perspective is, what if it wasn't just the content that you wanted to see, but the content
the advertisers
wanted you to see?
Yeah.
And that is what one of the venture capitalist who's invested in this company, he raised that possibility.
Well, of course.
One of the things that attracted him to it. And that is extra fascinating when you think about all of the privacy implications of the online world and online ad targeting using personal data. And I pressed the Misapplied Sciences founders on this topic. And for now, they're saying that they are thinking about those safeguards long term. And certainly there are ways to apply the principles of online privacy to the physical world. But right now, the technology itself is so mind-blowing that they're just hoping to show the world what is possible and then long term have that larger discussion about the societal implications.
Right. Remember when it was freaky that a billboard would change, would pixelate and become two or three billboards? Well, there's 100,000 billboards in the same space customized.
Yeah. And going back to the traffic example, I actually encounter this a lot. I mean, I think it might be a little radical to think about the yellow light going away, but think about the speed signs where it says your speed is, and you're going down Aurora Avenue down there toward downtown. And you're like, wait a second, is that my speed or is that the car behind me? Mm. With this kind of parallel reality, there would be no question because that view of the sign would be targeted specifically to your car.
Okay. But this company, Misapplied Sciences, in Redmond, is their venture capital tanking right along with the Facebook stock price as we're all recoiling at what happens when we give away data about ourselves?
I don't think so. And that's in part because a lot of this is not necessarily dependent on the advertising. That is certainly a long-term potential. But I think they could be a decade or decades away from really rolling it out and having those kinds of business implications. Right now, this is long-term potential that we're talking about here. And yet, the technology is there. And as I said, I took a couple colleagues with me over to Redmond a couple weeks ago to see this, because this, to me, is one of the most potentially groundbreaking things that we've seen in terms of the ability to change the way we perceive the world and to personalize the world for us. This is the kind of thing that has the potential to change all of that.
But here's another problem with personalizing. Don't we already each live in a parallel reality?
Absolutely.
That's a problem.
I raised this with the founders, and they acknowledged that, yes, this is something to think about. They're not yet at the point where they're talking about that publicly. They are, by the way, getting to the point where they're soon, they say, in the coming months, going to be releasing their first product. But this is kind of the physical manifestation of alternative facts, right?
Yes.
And I do think
we can't even agree on what reality is.
How are we going to have a shared and common experience if we look at the same sign and see different things?
Yes.
I do think that needs to be recognized. I think there need to be some ethical principles as these new technologies come out, and we need to think about them and talk about them. And it does raise those kinds of concerns.
Truly, I think about when I was a kid, a lot was in question, but I knew that seeing is believing, and you just see all of this shifting and changing.
Right. It is an issue and something that's worth talking about.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, mm-hmm. the magic pixel, the multi-view pixel,
yeah.
it is clearly a breakthrough tech-wise. There have been a variety of companies that have tried this sort of thing, and we should be clear. No glasses, no goggles.
Oh, right.
Nothing,
no headset.
Nothing bulky on your head.
I forgot to ask.
Naked eye.
Yeah.
It just works because of the way that the pixel works. So
okay.
Just in terms of geeking out over something, I mean,
yeah.
This is incredible. And then, okay, yeah, we do have to think about those bigger issues. But in the meantime, to be able to experience something like this firsthand is pretty cool.
Still geeky cool. Okay.
Yes.
Todd Bishop, Geeking Out, the co-founder, editor of GeekWire, and he saw the potential future of parallel reality and multi-view pixels in Redmond. And thanks a lot for telling us about it.
Absolutely.
I'm skeptical,
yep.
But I really like learning about it.
Sounds good.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. More of KUOW's The Record coming up. KUOW's The Record continues now. Facebook has been in the hot seat lately, as we've just said. We learned most recently that not 50 million, but 87 million people may have had their data leaked to that political firm Cambridge Analytica. A lot of people are reconsidering, right? Should I delete Facebook? Should I get in there and change my settings? How about you? Have you considered quitting Facebook? My next guest, Abby Olheiser, says that in her experience, going cold turkey might be your best bet. Abby is a digital culture reporter for The Washington Post, and she reported a piece on the challenges that people face in leaving Facebook. Abby, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
What did you find out about why it is, for some people, so hard to leave Facebook?
It's those personal connections that people joined Facebook for in the first place. You know, I interviewed one woman whose mother had recently died, and Facebook was where her family photos lived. It was where her mother's Facebook account had been memorialized. And so although she was upset with Facebook's privacy settings and she was concerned about how Facebook had handled harassment issues in the past, she just couldn't do it when it came time to decide whether to quit the site or not, because there were too many emotional ties. For other people, it might be that they have professional connections that they only can access on Facebook that they don't want to get rid of. They feel it might be detrimental to their career. Other people stay in touch with family and friends through the site. You know, other people use it to keep in touch with events in their community. There are lots and lots and lots of reasons why the people I've talked to have found it difficult to actually quit, even if they really want to.
Let's get into some of those. First, you mentioned personal photos and my mom's Facebook page. Can't I download that stuff from Facebook and then leave it?
Sure, you could. You can download all of your data from Facebook. It sort of comes in this big zip file. But I think the experience of browsing a giant zip file of raw data is a little bit different from visiting this page that sort of looks the way you expect it to look. You know, I can't speak for whether that woman I interviewed would find the experience equivalent or not. In her case, she decided keeping it on the site, keeping herself on that memorialized page was something that she needed to do emotionally.
I'm picturing a company that would take the data in this zip file and embed it in a wonderful, far more beautiful and touching site than what Facebook was doing.
I mean, maybe that's an interesting idea someone will take up if people actually start quitting Facebook.
Mm. You also mentioned professional, and I think of that. I know there's more than just what I know, but I think of LinkedIn as there's plenty of professional contacts on there. I don't think of myself as needing Facebook for that. And then family and friends and events. Well, let's talk about family and friends. Couldn't there be, instead of the global 2 billion person Facebook, what if we all just start migrating to smaller places like our neighborhoods? You know, this is just my family and friends.
You know, I think the answer to that question is probably different for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Not everyone has the same access to the internet or the same access to tools that might connect them to other people. You know, I think obviously we're both journalists. When we think about professional connections on Facebook, we might think immediately of the professional reasons to be on a social media platform or not. For other people, it might be that's where they get gigs in their community, right? If mm-hmm. they have a small business, maybe that's how they solicit customers. So there can be a lot of different reasons. I think when I talk to people who have quit, they generally do find ways to replace those connections that they had on the site, whether it's a group text with their family, whether it is, as you said, just being out in their community more. I mean, some people have even just started to rely on other kind of social networks with algorithmic feeds to provide them with news instead of Facebook. So, you know, it doesn't mean that you're completely getting off of the internet, right?
Yeah, so that's interesting. You talk to people who have quit, and would you say in general they're more or less happy once they quit Facebook?
The people I have talked to did not regret quitting Facebook. Both of them that I quoted in the article quit cold turkey. I believe neither of them downloaded their data. They just deleted their account and then let the people know who they wanted to stay in touch with that this is what had happened and how they could be reached. You know, they both told me that it changed their lives for the better. I think both of those people quit in a slightly different context. They were upset with the political discourse that was on Twitter and how it was affecting their relationships with their family and friends. And so it's a slightly different kind of wave of people who quit, but it was the same kind of impulse of, I don't like what Facebook is doing in my life and I'm going to change it by quitting. And in those cases, they didn't regret it.
Have you heard the old chestnut that you're either acting out of fear or love? I don't know whether that's true or not, but I wonder, do you find among the people who are using Facebook, do they seem to be getting something positive out of it? Or is it more like they fear missing out if they didn't have it?
That's a really good question. And I think, again, it depends on who you talk to. Mm-hmm. You know, one person I interviewed for my piece kind of put it this way, that, you know, Facebook doesn't have 2 billion users because it's not providing anything of value to people.
Right.
You know, it obviously provides some value to people. And I think, but when you're looking at that, it's also important to remember that Facebook is really, really good at doing kind of the core thing it does for you, which is show you things that you're going to want to interact with and share with and feel connected to. And that is to keep you on the site, to keep you coming back to the site. So, you know, it is something where people find value. It's not just a fear of missing out, I don't think, for everybody. But, you know, both of those things certainly come into play.
Do you see, Abby, this is Abby Olheiser with Washington Post who's reporting on this. Do you see the next Facebook or the Facebook alternative on the horizon? I've heard of Elo. I mean, there are other networks.
There have been so many other networks that have tried to become the next Facebook, and you know, none of them are close to building the same user base that Facebook has built. There was one, for example, several years ago called Diaspora that was very privacy-minded. Mm-hmm. Instead of having all your data hosted on Facebook servers, it would be hosted on these independent servers from the network that they called pods. And you could join whichever one you wanted, or you could host your own. But, you know, there are barriers to joining a platform that involves knowing how to join a server that might not be appealing to every user. It also depends on where you live. You know, for some people in, around the world, Facebook is really their gateway into the internet. So, you know, a Facebook alternative, it kind of depends on what you use Facebook for. But platforms like Elo, Diaspora, all these other alternatives, I think they may, for their group of users, provide something that they got from Facebook. But I would hesitate to say that anything I've seen is the next Facebook, just based on sheer numbers.
I've heard of ideas like, well, it shouldn't be free. Well, what if you were charged 99 cents or whatever it is? I've heard, what about a nonprofit like Wikipedia? Mm-hmm. I've heard, well, why doesn't the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? They provided an alternative to TV networks. Why couldn't we fund it that way? What do you think?
You know, that's another really good question. Actually, a colleague of mine just wrote a piece this afternoon about whether we should be paying for Facebook, or alternatively, whether Facebook should be paying us for the information we give them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think when I think about that, they're all very interesting ideas, but the question is, like, how would they be implemented? Are these things that Facebook would be doing themselves? Are these people talking about building kind of their own utopic alternative? You know, I think the answer depends on exactly how something like that would happen.
Well, you said that would be very difficult to imagine another network, social media network, reaching anything like Facebook's scale, and that seems right. But maybe we have soured on that early promise that Facebook is going to knit the world together in a global community. That just seems to be something that we don't believe in as much. So what if there's nothing ever like a 2 billion person Facebook, and that becomes okay with us, and we're just okay with shrinking back into smaller networks?
I think that's one thing to think about for sure as we go forward in the months after this sort of massive crisis of trust between Facebook and its users. You know, that kind of promise of connecting the world together is how Facebook has, since the beginning of its existence, advertised itself to the world. And I think, you know, some of its users, that is primarily how they feel about the site. That's how they felt about what it does for them. Others have been more skeptical. And I think it'll be interesting to see how many people actually do quit Facebook as a result of the kind of barrage of news stories about how this data is being used and who has had access to it and what they're doing with it. And if a lot of people quit, what happens with them next? But I think at this point, it's a little too early to say. We don't even know right now how many people are actually taking the time to delete their Facebook accounts in this moment.
Abby Olheiser is digital culture reporter at The Washington Post. I still have a Facebook account. I don't use it much anyway. I'm thinking of deleting it. What about you, Abby? Are you on Facebook?
I still have one, much to the chagrin of my father, who is a software engineer and has never joined.
Yeah. Sometimes father knows best.
Yeah. Yeah.
Abby Olheiser talking and reporting about the hold that Facebook has on our psyches. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you, Abby.
Yeah, thank you.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. 6 months after the Harvey Weinstein sexual assault allegations, the Pew Research Center reports nearly half of the men surveyed say it's gotten harder to interact with female colleagues. I think I know what they mean. We have some advice for those men from Seattle writer, New York Times columnist Lindy West. So great to see you again.
Great to see you too.
Why do you think, if you buy this Pew survey, why do you think that some men find it harder to interact with female colleagues these days?
I mean, it's a little baffling. There are all kinds of things that we don't do all the time every day. Like, I don't find it hard to not go hit my colleagues with a hammer, you know? But I think, I mean, I don't want to be too harsh, but I think a lot of men have been getting away with a lot for a long time and haven't had to think very hard about their behavior. And when you've been completely unfettered, any small request for a, you know, minor restriction feels like a grave oppression.
I don't know that I'm certainly not speaking for all the dudes, but I had a couple back when I was single many years ago. I've had in my professional career a couple of relationships that started at work. So to that extent of I can remember going to work and being aware of gender, you know, and thinking that was normal.
Sure.
Do you think that gender is something that should have no place in the workplace? Should we have blinders on about that?
I mean, you know, we're all human beings,
yeah,
and we're stuck in workplaces 40 hours a week for many of us. And obviously, it's not realistic to say that no one should have feelings for their coworkers or crushes or any kind of, gendered complication, but you know, we can be professionals. I mean, like, this is part of the job, is to be a professional.
You actually have some advice.
I do.
Along those lines.
I threw together some, I mean, I carefully came up with some very helpful wisdom.
Yeah.
I mean, this question is so, you know, it just seems so melodramatic. Like, I don't even know how to talk to women now. Like, really? I don't know. Do you know how to talk to your mom?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how to talk to your child? Like, come on, you can do this. But
that's the theme. It's like, you can do this.
Yeah, pretty sure you can do this. Come on. And, you know, yeah, I understand that the stakes are higher because now there are consequences that maybe weren't there before.
Mm-hmm.
But you should have been behaving yourself before. You just didn't have to because there were no consequences. So really, your situation has not changed. You were behaving badly
before
and after the consequences. So anyway, but I did. I wrote up some tips. Okay.
Yeah.
Tip number one. And I hope I'm allowed to say all these words. I think I am. Okay. You checked them, right?
Yeah.
Okay. unless you work in a genital related field, do not talk about genitals at the office.
There you go.
I mean, that seems like a low bar.
Doable.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Right? And if you have a deep driving need to talk about genitals at the office, like you just feel like this is a part of who you are.
Mm-hmm. That's non-negotiable.
Non-negotiable.
You get me, you get the genital conversation.
Uh-huh. You know what? Go ahead and enroll in medical school, toil for 12 years or however long it takes, and become a urologist.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not a gynecologist if
maybe
you
not.
Have this kind of creepy genital drive.
Yes.
Not that I want to subject the... I mean, I guess women... Okay, hold on.
Okay, back
up. We're getting off the rails. But yeah. I'm just saying...
there's a place for you.
There's a place, a time and a place, mm-hmm. where you could work at the sex toy store.
Sure.
But then you should still not... That's not a...
It's still a workplace.
Right, that's not a pass to just sexually harass your colleagues.
Mm.
So I would just say that as a general rule for most of us, no genitals.
No genitals.
At the office.
Good.
It's a general genital rule.
And if you find yourself being more genital aware than you want to, you had a little... A picture we could replace that with.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking, I was trying to think of what's the least sexy place on earth.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be the like the Windows store.
Yes.
Like the Microsoft Windows brick and mortar store. Just picture, close your eyes, pretend you're at the Windows store.
Right. And you also point out that you might not think you know how to interact non-sexually with other people. Probably you do know how.
You do. You know, you'd surprise yourself. Think about how you might conduct yourself at your child's band recital.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I'm there.
You're at the elementary school. You're watching kids play the recorder.
Yep.
Are you grabbing people?
No.
Are you?
I'm not.
No, you're not, right?
There's no sexy thoughts.
Picture yourself. Okay, so your beloved sister, she's had a long day at work, and she has a twinge in her shoulder, and she says, could you squeeze my shoulder for a second? You're giving your sister a shoulder massage.
Uh-huh.
Are you saying creepy aggressive?
No, I'm managing that. No problem.
Yeah. Maybe comport yourself like you're in the process of being arrested. Are you sexually harassing the officer?
No.
There are all kinds of situations.
Right.
Where that you navigate with ease.
Right.
Without sexually harassing anyone.
It's like if you go to a bar. You said.
I said, yes.
And some people might think, wait a minute, a bar?
A bar is a great place to sexually harass people.
But if, in fact, it's the minority of interactions at a bar.
Presumably, you go to a bar, there are all kinds of people there that you are not attracted to, that you are not going to go home and have sex with.
Mm-hmm.
Say you're at a bar with 100 people, 99 of those people, maybe, you're not going to even have any kind of interaction with. Why not treat your coworkers like they're the other 99 people at the bar?
Yes. There's a mental model.
Right?
Yes.
Oh, this is a person that I'm not going to take home from the bar and sleep with.
In fact, you had the idea of how to interact with your female colleagues. How could I frame that in my mind?
Yes. Okay. So, idea.
Mm-hmm.
Interact with your female colleagues the way you interact with your male colleagues, except more specifically because... Mm-hmm. The way that you interact with your male colleagues is probably sometimes gross. Interact with your female colleagues the way you would interact with your male colleagues if a powerful female superior was in the room.
Got it.
Like you have a female boss who could fire you at any second.
Right.
You and your male colleagues are not trading stories from, you know, the strip club last night or whatever.
Right. It's not probably not going to come up even once.
Like what I'm trying trying to say is we have these boundaries already.
Yes.
It's just been very easy for people to trample all over them. And I don't even, I'm generalizing and I'm saying men. Clearly women can sexually harass people too. And if you're a woman who loves to sexually harass people, feel free to apply these rules to yourself as well.
Yes. In fact, final rule, how about just do work when you're at work?
Yeah, I know it's a complicated concept, but when you're at work, do your work. Just work when you're at work. How about that? I think it's important to remember that the other people at your work, they might be nice to you and they might like you, but they are forced to be around you.
Yes.
It is a mutually captive experience, and the least you can do is make it as pleasant for everyone as possible.
Lindy West, Seattle writer, author of the book Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. There was a survey in Vox that found 60% of women are concerned that the Me Too movement will lead to decreased opportunities for women in the workplace. Do you get that?
I've heard people say that, yeah. Does that mean we shouldn't do it? I don't quite know what the utility of that worry is. I guess they're saying that men are going to be afraid to hire women because with women come sexual harassment lawsuits. So I don't really see why we should punish women for that failing of men, you know?
Yeah.
I think if what we want to do is get, like, what you need to do is create and foster sort of equality and gender parity at all levels of your organization. So you need, you know, women who are doing the hiring and women who are in charge and not just men who are choosing whether or not to hire women and whether or not to be afraid of women. And, you know, I just feel like it's a much more complex problem. And the solution is certainly not to roll back sexual harassment protections.
You were saying, why not try the concept of just doing work when you're at work? We do talk personal stuff, non-work related stuff at work, and mostly it's okay and normal and even positive. Could you see a scenario where in some enlightened future, we now gender or bodies or sex is something that we've figured out how to talk about in a way that is not problematic, and it's welcomed back into the fold of non-work related things? Or is just like work and gender forever and bodies and parts forever separated, or should be?
I don't know. maybe. I mean, yeah, I guess if we get to the point where it's not fraught to talk about sex at work, then it's not fraught to talk about sex at work. But that's a pretty big hypothetical. And And it's not, again, it's totally unrealistic to think that people aren't going to flirt with each other at work and people aren't going to get embroiled in weird crushes. Obviously, this is going to happen. But I would urge people who, if people are afraid of maybe not being able to comport themselves appropriately, err on the side of not.
Yeah.
You know?
Lindy West, again, the book is Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman, and she's a New York Times writer. I love your column regularly. That's a good day when you have a column in the New York Times. Or The Guardian. Did you see that Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook was talking to reporters yesterday about the data breach? And he was saying, oh, instead of 50 million, it was more like 87 million people. So it just gets worse. It's been more than a year since you deleted Twitter. Are you thinking of deleting Facebook?
Oh, sure. I think about it all the time. And I thought about it before I deleted Twitter. I mean, social media is wonderful, but it's also, even aside from all this creepy data stuff, it's exhausting. I don't like having access to that many people's thoughts and opinions at any moment. And I don't like that many people having access to me all the time, necessarily. You know, it just gets, you start to feel like, I feel stretched very thin when I spend a lot of time on social media. You know, just like a lot of people want to talk to you about every single detail of their life. And so anyway, I was already kind of getting burned out, I guess. But, you know, I I also am a writer and I write in my house and I never see any other human beings. And the idea of totally cutting off social media is a little bit sad. You know, like, as like, yeah, Facebook is probably evil and definitely terrifying and ruins my day often. Mm-hmm. I mean, my God, if you just try to ask Facebook, like, hey, Facebook, where should I buy socks? And they're like, socks? Ever heard of sandals? They're shoes that you can wear without socks. Like, it's just like you can't even ask a question without people trying to ruin your life. Because people are just addicted to being condescending. So I don't need that in my life. But also, I do want to see pictures of your baby and your cat. So I don't know. I can't figure it out.
I was just talking to a reporter about how Facebook burrows into our psyches, but she was saying that most people she talks to, she did a bunch of reporting on this, they report that their lives are better since they left Facebook.
I believe it. Yeah. I believe it. I mean, my life's definitely better since I left Twitter.
Why is that?
I just have a lot more time. You know, I think we've sort of been tricked into thinking that it's a good thing to constantly be connected to other people. Virtually. And I don't know that it is, you know, and in my case, I was constantly connected to a lot of people who hate me and hate my work. And it was like this steady drip of criticism and degradation and really, really cruel stuff. And I don't think that's good for your brain. I mean, it certainly wasn't good for mine. And not being on Twitter. Yeah, I miss the good parts of Twitter, but I also spend a lot more time just sitting on the couch with my kids and walking around Seward Park with my husband. You know what I mean? It's that's the main thing, is just time, to not always have my brain buried in my phone.
Do you think we've societally learned some kind of lesson from Facebook that you know, we thought that seems cool, a global community, you know, people interacting and being brought close together. Do you think we are learning this lesson that, you know, we're social animals, but there's humans out there. I can do it that way.
I mean, I don't want to sound like one of these people who's like, oh, this technology.
I know. I don't want to be a, you know, it's the new bragging that you're off of Facebook,
right,
or you never use Facebook. I don't want to be that guy.
Right.
But, you know,
I mean,
I'm
love
attention.
Instagram. I love Instagram. It's so peaceful there.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you know, I don't think that social media is all bad. And I don't think that Twitter was all bad. I think it's actually really, really powerful. And so is Facebook. I've seen, you know, I've made great friends on Facebook. I've seen a lot of amazing organizing on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there just are, there are a lot of things that tech companies could do to make their platforms safer for users. And there are a lot of things that, you know, individuals could do to just think about the way that we treat each other virtually, just like we're changing, you know, we're having these conversations about how we treat each other in real life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, it's just a communication tool. So any problems with these social networks are cultural problems, and they're human problems and things that we need to figure out as a society. It's not that Facebook is evil. It's that it was made by humans and it's full of humans and people are great and terrible.
Well, I'm kind of hoping that social media thickens our skin, that wouldn't it be nice if we learned the lesson we were always telling our kids about sticks and stones and, you know, break your bones, that maybe somebody says something about me on Twitter and I'm still okay.
Yeah.
Maybe that would be good.
I mean, that certainly happened to me. But I don't know if it was good or not. Mm. You know, I feel hardened.
Oh yeah.
A little bit, and not, I was thinking about, I, you know, maybe 5 years ago, I did a little storytelling show, and it came to me this morning. I was thinking about the little story that I told, and it was, you were supposed to sort of confess something or say something taboo that you're not supposed to say. And I confessed that at that time in my job, I was at Jezebel, and I was pretty new at Jezebel. So I was on a national platform and I was just getting hounded every day. And I confessed in this little story that I cried every day. And this suddenly came to me this morning, and that's so foreign to me now. You know, I really felt every single comment and took it personally, and it really, every single one got through to me. And I kind of think that's the normal human way to be. You know, now people come at me all the time, not so much now that I'm off Twitter, but by the time I left Twitter, I mean, my God, the things that I could brush off were just barbaric. And I don't know that that's a better way to be. It's I feel like something's lost there. You know, some kind of poor, like permeability or like, you know, a softness that I don't necessarily think that sensitivity is bad or that vulnerability is bad. I think our parameters are a little out of whack here.
Mm. Yeah. Now I miss this slightly more vulnerable Lindy. Listen, we have just time to tell people about this event on Sunday, April 15th, Benaroya Hall. You're at Benaroya Hall. The event is called The Witches Are Coming. What's going to happen?
Just going to talk about our present moment and the power that we have as a collective. You know, I think people, it's easy to feel alone. It's easy to fall into despair right now. And I want to get a bunch of people in a room together and talk about how powerful we are.
That's going to be a good experience if you can be with Lindy West. And she's going to be at Benaroya Hall Sunday, April 15th. Thanks a lot, Lindy.
Thank you.
Good to see you. And thank you for listening to The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimma Brempong, Jason Pagano, with help from Casey Martin, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, we review the news of the week in review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.